Good morning, Laurier, and welcome back to another episode of Radio Laurier News at Noon. Today we have a very special guest for you. We have Professor Alistair Edgar of the Poli-Sci Department at Wilfrid Laurier here to talk to us about the coup in Myanmar. Keep listening to find out more.
Yeah, thanks everybody for tuning in. It is March 30th. This is, I think, is actually our second last show. So we thought we'd have a little guest, interview, make it more interesting than our previous shows. Just for any listeners, today we're going to be talking about the coup going on in Myanmar. I'm going to give really quickly like a little 60-second some information about it, just in case anyone doesn't really know. I'm sure most of our viewers by now sort of know what's going on. So just really quickly, the coup began on the 1st of February 2021. It's actually interesting that a fitness instructor who was doing sort of like a yoga or something caught the coup going on in the back, like the military going to arrest the government leaders. So that's actually kind of interesting. You can find that online. So Myanmar used to be Burma, spent 124 years under British rule. There was a coup in 1962, so this is not sort of the first time this has happened. And during the coup, the previous leader, not official, but unofficial leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who pushed for democracy, was actually imprisoned by the military, which has outraged many. But we'll get into that later, because that's actually probably one of the most interesting aspects of this whole story. And finally, just to finish it off, the military, the person in power, the leader of the military, is Min Aung Hlaing. And he's actually one of the most wanted men in the world for his role in the Rohingya genocide, essentially. And yeah, let's get straight into it with some questions for Dr. Edgar. So Doctor, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of the country's social and political climate before the coup, sort of most notably the situation going on with the Rohingya and the other sort of ethnic minorities.
Sure, happy to do that and happy to join you on the show. It's, as you mentioned, this is not the first coup. In fact, there has been largely a military government for the last 45 years in Myanmar. And indeed, the military government renamed Burma as Myanmar, because Burma was the two things, the name largely given to it by the British, but also reflecting the Burman majority population. So we've had 40-odd years of military rule. The junta effectively closed off Myanmar from the rest of the world in similar ways to North Korea, turned it into a hermit kingdom. In their case, a hermit kingdom supported militarily, as it still is, by China and Russia, or what was then the Soviet Union, but China and Russia. There has been a history of ethnic conflict, or civil war, if you will, lots of civil wars around Myanmar, as different groups, ethnic groups and others, have reacted against the authoritarian government of the military junta. So there is a coup now, but for example, in Rakhine State, the Arakan army, the Arakanese, have been fighting for a decade or more. So there is sectarian division, ethnic division, other divisions, ongoing conflicts, if you want, in the geographical periphery of Myanmar. And the leader you mentioned, Aung San Suu Kyi, as the leader of what arguably is a pro-democratic government, was under house arrest for 15 years by the military junta, and was released by them in 2010, just before they held their first multi-party election in 2011. And she's the Nobel Prize winner for peace. Everybody looking at her saw her as a voice for freedom So she was released. Her party, the National League for Democracy, the NLD party, won that 2011 election. And the constitution doesn't allow her to be called president or prime minister, but she was the de facto head of state under the new civilian government from 2011 onwards. And this is where more of the complexity comes, because in 2016-17, you mentioned the Rohingya, military power, still behind the throne, if you will, the military power in Myanmar, engaged in what they called anti-terrorism, what we called mass expulsion, crimes against humanity, and acts of genocide against the Rohingya population in Rakhine State, which led to 700,000 of them being expelled to Bangladesh. And we have lots of evidence, and UN inspectors have confirmed, you know, burning of villages, mass atrocity crimes, etc. What's interesting in an unfortunate sense is that Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Prize winner, defended the military junta and said that this was not genocide, that this was not mass atrocities, that this was defending security and stability in Myanmar against terrorist groups and rebels. So she, there was a lot of outrage that she would do this, and indeed people asked for her to be stripped of her Nobel Prize, which you can't actually do, but asked for her to be stripped of her Nobel Prize. And she went to the International Court of Justice in The Hague and defended Burma, Myanmar, against the charges of genocide there. So it's, I'll stop at this point. It's interesting that there's not outrage, or there's not a great deal of sympathy for her now that she has been arrested by the military junta, because in a sense, the human rights activists and others who loved her in 2010-11 are outraged and disgusted by her in 2020.
Yeah, that was a great explanation. Yeah, I think it's very interesting, very strange how she won the Nobel Peace Prize and then this. And it's also, there's a tie to Ethiopia, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, who also won a Nobel Prize, I think, in 2019, and now is involved in a brutal civil war. So these sort of relationships and connections I find are very strange, but also very, very interesting to look at. Rajni, do you wanna ask a question?
Yeah, actually, just to follow up with the first point, to what extent do you think that her defense of the military was like voluntary, or would you say it could have been coerced? Because given the environment that we just described, I feel as though there may not have been like a lot of leeway for her to actually actively condemn them openly. You see what I mean?
And it's certainly a question that people ask. And one response I have to that, I'm sure there's not a lot of leeway in a sense, but I don't think we can say that she was intimidated or cowed by the military junta, because after all, she had remained resolute in opposing them during her time in house arrest. So I don't think you can say this is a woman who is afraid of the military or confront people who might arrest her. She's absolutely not. She's demonstrated that. So I don't think it's a matter of her being personally afraid of being put under house arrest or something like that. So if I wanted to find an excuse for her, and frankly I don't, but if I wanted to find an excuse for her defending it, then you could say she's making a political calculation that if she stood up and spoke out against the regime, then they would do what they've done now, arrest the civilian leaders and carry on. So she was trying to avoid that and trying to make time and space for consolidation of democracy. But that would be me trying to be very generous to her.
Yeah.
And I, because a simple way of getting back at that is, that the constitution that the military put into place left them with great power. They weren't going away anywhere. They can always do this. So if she actually wants to stand up for principles, then she should have stood up for principles in 2016-17 and said, no, this is wrong.
For sure.
And she would have had international support behind that.
Definitely. And so how would you say that the recent events have reflected on her past achievements in the field of democracy? Well,
the coup is a different thing altogether. I think what has ruined her reputational credibility permanently is that defense of the regime committing genocide. At this point, since she didn't complain or defend, she didn't complain about that, it's hard to take her seriously in that sense if she's complaining about this. Because you know now it's being done to her. She doesn't like it. She didn't care that it was being done to the Rohingyas. That's completely separate from what the military is doing with the coup. And the fact that the military is murdering their own citizens, again, if you will, but murdering their own citizens, protected by Russia and China, who are there. The major military sponsors. As you mentioned, General Hang is now, you know, one of the world's most wanted or most condemned for what's going on there. So, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi has ruined her reputation. That's separate from excusing anything that the military junta is doing, doing right now.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't think she can really do anything at this point to salvage what she's done. But Dr. Edgar, I noticed that you've actually written a book or a publication called The Changing Role of the United Nations in Managing Armed Conflict. So I was going to ask you sort of, do you think the UN has any ability to sort of mitigate the coup or the damages or the violence through sanctions or through peacekeeping? Or do you think this is just going to have to, this is going to be like a prolonged sort of conflict?
Two things. I know it sounds like a very academic and professorial thing to say, but the UN, the answer depends on which UN you're talking about. Let me clarify that. There's two different kinds of UN in a sense. The UN Security Council, which is what most people think of. The UN Security Council right now is will not approve external intervention because China and Russia both support the military junta, and on the Security Council, they are two of the permanent five, and they have veto power, as do the three others, UK, France, and the United States. And bear in mind that Myanmar is right there beside China, right? You know, geographically, it is a neighbor. So there wouldn't be a question anyway of American or other forces going in there. It might be that with witnessing enough of the carnage that's going on, China and Russia might approve a regional force going in. But then Thailand has been an ally of the West for some time, so it couldn't be Thai forces, etc. So there's the politics of the Security Council. That's a complex issue to deal with. The other part of the UN, what I would call the permanent UN, the UN of the UN Secretariat and the High Representative of the UN there and the UN Special Rapporteur, I mean, they're all over TV right now condemning what's going on there. Like the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has publicly condemned what's going on. The UN Special Rapporteur, actually I was watching him interviewed on the BBC last night, And he's calling for sanctions. What he can do, in a sense, is try to put moral pressure on the Chinese and the Russians in the Security Council to allow sanctions through the Security Council. At the same time, other countries on their own, Canada on its own, as you know, has. Declared what the Chinese are doing to the Uyghurs as genocide, and they're engaging in sanctions targeted sanctions on that basis. Other countries can do the same thing here, and some are, but other countries can do the same thing here without waiting for the Security Council. So you've got what individual countries can do. They can do whatever they want to do in terms of declaring sanctions. What the permanent UN, the Secretary General and the Secretariat can do, and they're doing that, they are condemning what's going on, and also trying to collect information for the potential future war crimes trials or crimes against humanity trials. So collecting criminally viable evidence to hold the regime accountable. And then there is the, what can the Security Council authorize? It could authorize whatever it chooses to, but China and Russia, their generals, you know, yesterday and the day before, when the regime was being reported as shooting up to 150 or 170, killing 150 to 170 of its own people and protesters, they were having military parades, and the Russian and Chinese generals were right in the middle of it all, hugging General Lang. So they're not about to do anything.
That's fascinating to me. That is so interesting, China and Russia's role into this. I wasn't fully aware of, I knew China was sort of an ally, but that is fascinating to me. Rajan, you want to go?
Yeah, and so given all of that, what would you say this whole situation means for the future of democracy? Because I feel like we've seen, it kind of was like a light in the dark a couple of years back when Aung San Suu Kyi was actually released from house arrest, but now everything seems like it's just going back to how it used to be. So do you see this like getting better anytime soon, or?
You know, a lot of it, General Lang isn't going to go anywhere. He's not about to, you know, convert to democracy and see the light or anything like that, nor are any of his military supporters. The military itself will do what it's told at the level of soldier. If there's going to be progress there, then it has to come through and it will be slow. The population itself will manage somehow to overthrow the government. That doesn't seem likely. They don't have the weapons or capacity, and I'm not sure we'd want to see a full-fledged civil war with the destruction that would take place in Myanmar at that point. But if there's going to be a political solution, then it has to come in some form or another through getting China and Russia on board, getting them to pressure Lang, because he will listen to them. He's not going to listen to protests from China, Russia, from China, the United States, or Britain, or others.
Definitely.
From Canada, sorry, or Britain, or others. But if you can get China and Russia behind the scenes, in a sense, to talk to the military junta and say, you've got to wind this down. This cannot continue. They're not going to do that because they're worried about the population of Myanmar. You've got to find out what it is that gets their interest in this, because they're interested in, you know, natural resources, gas, oil, minerals, these things. And Russia's interested in arms sales. How can you get them interested in putting pressure on the military junta to back off?
Yeah.
They're not going to apologize. They're not going to go on trial. They're not going to do any of those things. I don't know what the secret would be to get them to put pressure on the junta, but that's where the solution would have to come.
For sure.
Those are some very interesting insights. We'll probably just have maybe one more question. So I was wondering, in terms of sort of the geopolitical relationship in the region, so with Bangladesh, with Thailand, with other sort of developing countries, do you think this sort of conflict is going to spill over, especially with the refugee situation, and sort of damage these countries? Or do you think it's going to be more of a contained sort of problem?
There is some spillover happening right now. Thailand on the eastern border is reporting seeing some displaced persons. You know, there have been reports of airstrikes against some villages and populations on the border. Now, this partly goes back to, as I mentioned before, the civil wars or the civil conflicts that were going on separately from this. So there have been airstrikes by the Myanmar military that have put a few thousand refugees across the border into Thailand. So we're seeing some of that, and certainly you can get people being pushed out into Thailand that way. We've already got the problem of the Rohingyas in Bangladesh, and the fact that they were pushed across to Bangladesh, and Bangladesh is, don't need to get too technical, but they're a signatory state, a state party for the International Criminal Court, led the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court to ask for permission to investigate the Rohingya expulsion as a crime against humanity. Not genocide, just technical reasons, not genocide, but a crime against humanity that was begun in Myanmar and completed, if you will, on the territory of a member state. So you've got the ICC potentially engaging in investigation and indictment of the military and the senior military leaders for crimes against humanity against the Rohingya. So you've already got it coming out of the country in that sense as an ICC case. You've already got it coming out of the country physically with 700,000 refugees in Bangladesh. That is not upsetting, in a sense, destabilizing Bangladesh. There's not a security crisis in Bangladesh. It's a humanitarian crisis in Bangladesh. And if something comes across the border, if refugees come across the border in Thailand, it'll be another humanitarian crisis. The conflict itself is not spilling out across the border. So it's not going to become, in that sense, a threat to international peace and security. It is an international legal or criminal law issue, and it is a humanitarian or a refugee issue. And obviously, inside of the country itself, it is an issue of life and death.
Well, I suppose that can be seen as somewhat positive, sort of, because just looking at a similar situation in Ethiopia, that sort of civil war has really destabilized Sudan, Eritrea. It's really kind of messed up the Horn of Africa. So I guess you could look at this as a kind of positive thing. But
in a sense, what it reminds me of, and this goes back a ways, is the conflict in Bosnia, which went on for 5 years, 4 years, 1992 to 96. But the conflict in Bosnia, which had refugees and internally displaced persons and a couple of 100,000 people killed in that conflict, but the actual conflict did not come outside of the country. I think this will be the same, but I don't want to spend 4 years watching people being killed in Myanmar. So hopefully it will not end up as that kind of a scenario.
Yeah, I completely agree. Maybe one last quick question, Rajni, anything?
Yeah, sure. So you had mentioned that individual countries can place sanctions on Burma. So I had read that apparently sanctions are not always effective because at the end of the day, it doesn't affect the government or the military people that much. It really just affects the people on the ground. So would you be able to expand a little bit on why it doesn't do much for the government?
Well, there's two things. I mean, again, very technical, but it depends what kind of sanctions. You know, let's completely sanction all forms of trade in and out of Myanmar. Well, that's not going to work because Myanmar sits right next to China. They will continue to trade. But the regime does earn money through oil exports. The regime does earn money through other exports, as well as far less through things like tourism. But you can target, you know, what are their chief revenue streams? And you can target those revenue streams for sanctions. You can also identify specific military leaders, as the International Criminal Court is doing, and indict them criminally, which means that should they ever choose to at least in theory, should they choose to travel outside of the country and they come to a country which is a signatory to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, they're meant to be apprehended and transferred to The Hague. So you've got that side of it, and you can put other individual sanctions, what we call smart sanctions, against those individuals. Do they have, and you can look, one can look into these, do they have financial assets outside of China too, but mm-hmm. do they have financial assets out there? Do they have assets in the market? And you can put sanctions on those. You can freeze those assets. So there's probably, and here I am not a financial transactions mm-hmm. expert, but I would say there's probably hundreds of millions, if not a small number of billions of dollars of revenue that you could try to put freeze onto.
Definitely.
And that would damage them. That would damage their capacity to pay their military. That would damage their capacity to buy equipment. So you can target them in some ways, but not in ways that there's no point in cutting off the entire country and hoping something will happen. That doesn't work.
Yeah, it's good that you clarified that, because I feel as though many people think of, when you say sanctions, they just think of blanket sanctions against the country, like trade embargoes or just stop traveling there kind of things. And yeah. if you take like a heavy-handed approach like that, it really just hurts the people who are actually suffering already, as opposed to the government.
Yeah, that would make absolutely no difference to the military junta. And in fact, it might even embolden them
yeah. to
their appeal orders. So no, you target the people at the top with sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're coming to time. This was an amazing conversation. Thank you so much, Dr. Edgar, for coming on. I learned a lot, and I've done a bit of research here and there. So yeah, this was great. Raj, you want to do an outro?
Yeah, sure. So thanks, Dr. Edgar, for taking time out of your day to come on to our show and inform us a bit more about the situation going on in Myanmar. And thank you, everyone, for listening to our show and watching this week's episode, because it will also be video streamed on YouTube. So we'll be signing off right now, and we hope to see you next week. Thank you for listening.
Take care, guys.